Well, there is a new unstoppable movement that's fixing almost everything wrong with America's healthcare. It's called direct care, and by sidestepping entrenched extractive middles, employers and consumers alike can eliminate all the built-in confusion, gaming, all the tyranny. Because direct care pays for itself, so the members and white coats are doubling every 3 years. Welcome to the new healthcare economy, where everyone wins.
Redirect Health. I chose Redirect Health as our sponsor for a few reasons. I'm a happy client 5 years now, and our most downloaded shows by far are Redirect Health shows. No one has a health plan for small employers more focused on reducing healthcare costs than Redirect Health. They have over 3,000 Google 5-star ratings and growing daily, and they average 4.6 stars overall. So stay tuned for your free report at the end of this show. Business Owner's Guide to Slashing Healthcare Premiums. Get.redirecthealth.com/run.
And now to the show.
John Torinas, who is the CEO of Wisconsin-based Serigraph, has saved almost $31 million with a $2 million spend for their 1,000 employees based in Wisconsin. He was an early adopter of a direct care model, and he remains a champion today and writes about it a lot. Self-insurance in and of itself, he says, is not the answer, but leads to a creation of health plans that revolve around employee behaviors to manage the health of their families and their purchasing decisions when they need care. Here are some of the major building blocks of the health plan devised by these cutting-edge companies. So this is what he considers an ideal health plan. 2 years ago, when they started doing a roadshow for the first 75 employers in Wisconsin, they now have 1,000 in this coalition that our guest today led and started. The first thing is a catastrophic wrapper known as a stop-loss insurance. That's step one. Then you have on-site or near-site primary care. Some, like the Rice Lake Clinic, is open 40 hours a week, and some have more modest setups. The leading companies also have a care navigator because it's impossible for an individual who can't possibly understand pricing to get the best deal and the best outcome and the best quality. They often go, low price and quality often go hand in hand. Direct contracts with centers of excellence are another part of this new architecture. So a lot of people travel a state or travel out of state to cut the deals and get the best prices with high quality clinics. The rebel companies are also hiring independent pharmacy managers that bring huge savings. Drug costs are more than 20% of a company's health costs bill. Other channels, such as purchasing from Canada, can sharply lower pharmaceutical charges. Outrageous lab costs are also brought under control when sourced through an on-site clinic or through a center of excellence. And finally, the claims processing is done by BUCAs has to be replaced when these companies go self-insured. Thus, the BUCA-free companies use independent TPAs to essentially administer a company health plan and offer include the navigation function often. Okay, so that leads us perfectly into our round two with Matt Ort. You heard him last week. And we promised to talk about ideal plan design, and that there it is. There's one ideal plan design, and let's see what Matt has in mind too. 3 years later now. This was in 2021 when this was written. So Matt Ort co-founded the Self-Fund Health to help brokers and employers be able to write their own healthcare success stories. Self-Fund Health combines a traditional TPA, a PBM, direct primary care, and direct contracts under a single technology platform to dramatically simplify what's needed for employers to succeed. Matt, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Ron. It's great to be with you.
This is my favorite topic. And I mean, it's just so many different ideal plan designs. You have given a lot of thought to this. You've seen a lot of this in action. You had, five mature companies that have saved over $5 million a year for 5 years, and you've watched how they've done it. What are your thoughts on ideal plan design, according to John Torinas?
Yeah, this is a fascinating topic. So John really deserves the credit for starting this movement in Wisconsin and potentially even, contributing nationally. Yeah, his book was the first of its kind, The Company That Solved Healthcare. And this started for him. He's in his late 80s today, a friend of mine. He, way back in the early 2000s, That article you referenced was him visiting a roadshow educational event that we started having throughout the state of Wisconsin. We've done 10 or 12 of those, and we're going bigger this year. Everything you said in that ideal plan design, which is really my quest, and as the listeners probably know, and you know, when you buy a fully insured plan, it's built, assembled, and everything is there for you. You pay your premium and so forth. Now, with the self-funded side, you've got to build all this from scratch. And so that's what we've done at Self-Fund Health, is assemble this proven plan. But as I was in the shoes of the VP of HR at Merrill Steel, we started essentially from scratch, knowing nothing what we know today. We had John's book as a reference. And honestly, there are a few others out there, but that was almost it in terms of from the employer perspective. So my book is the second of its kind. And so I would agree with everything that John said there in that article, although we could certainly get into the weeds. And I might phrase things a little differently. I think I have some neat insight to share there. My model would consist of 30 to 35 pieces, all related to those things or as subheadings under those things that you mentioned.
Well, let's start with your biggest source of disagreement. Now, we are both agreeing. We're disagreeing at the foot of an angel, right? I mean, nothing here is to criticize the great man, but you have been able to polish the diamond a little bit in the last several years. And I've talked to a lot of very smart people too, that I think this can be a great conversation to ping pong back and forth. So tell me, what are the first three or four things you see in that look a little dated today?
Yeah, no, a great, very enjoyable discussion. And also to mention just a quick point, you know, I mean, there's no maybe one right way here. So just because this is John's opinion or Matt's opinion, you know, doesn't mean the others are wrong. It's just what we've done. So it might even depend on the area or the state that you're in. I would say the first thing is just as a mindset, and I'll dig in here and get you some meat on the bone. You know, but the first thing is you've got to begin to think for yourself, and you've got to get out of that insurance box. You've got to get out of that box, and you've got to get away from that game that the insurance industry has handed us, because that game is a win-lose game. It's a win for the sellers and it's a lose for the buyers. So first and foremost, you know, what would we call a benefit expert today? Within employers, a benefit expert is someone who understands networks, who understands deductibles, who understands premiums, who understands, right, all the game that the insurance industry has handed us. And I would argue that the definition of an expert is very different, very different. The first, you know, there's a couple of areas you could start with. I'm not sure the order matters here, but there are three big categories that I, you know, as major headings that I would phrase this answer in. Number one is trustworthy partners. Number two, again, you could alternate one and two, is a financial strategy. And number three is a medical strategy. And I think most of the meat is under the medical strategy, but those would be the big headings that I would give.
Okay, let's go for the big juicy ones first. What are the easiest low-hanging fruits under medical strategy?
So medical strategy, what I think what you shared, what John had shared, would fall under that. So very much in agreement with what he said, right? So things, first and foremost, you've got to secure stop loss. Now that could be in the form of a captive, which introduces another shared layer, especially if you start grouping companies, group health plans, if you will, that are doing proactive things in healthcare. Now you have a pretty big advantage. So a captive can be an advantage if you're doing that. If you're just randomly grouping companies together, then I'm not sure a captive has any advantage. But as John mentioned, or a stop loss. So for our plan, for instance, we're working with different stop loss MGUs. TPAC out of the Twin Cities has been the most productive and cooperative and excited with us. And they give us a decrement because of our plan, because of the plan and what it can do. After that, was my first step at Merrill Steel, happened to be an on-site clinic. Now, I always, independent on-site clinic, and that first word is pretty key, and there's reasons for that. Now, it's a very important to mention, though, that we were big enough for an on-site, but near-site is just, I would say, equally as effective. and it works pretty much the same. There are minor advantages and disadvantages to both that I have in that I explain in my book, but it doesn't have to be on site. Near site can do this model just the same.
Yeah, the one of our guests called it near fence. There are dozens of companies that I've had the CEOs or chief medical officers on my show that do near-site and on-site DPC. So the problem with DPC on DPC Frontier is it says there's 250,000 members and a couple of thousand locations that are Kool-Aid stands. You can't have a Kool-Aid stand if you're Merrill Steel and you've got five locations around the country, right? You have to have a regional or a national solution, which is what created this whole industry. So did y'all go through a selection process to interview? And I mean, I got to tell you, it's hard to find these companies to interview because they're all under different headings. Like you can't just Google near-site, on-site and get 31 companies to pop up. It takes some digging.
Yeah, I think we were still pioneering at that stage, and that isn't it wasn't all that long ago. But as we started in 16, there was an article out of Madison that said there were 16 DPCs in 2021. Today, I count 104. Now, DPC Frontier, I'm glad to help them, but they only show 20 or 25 in Wisconsin. So I'm not sure where the gap is, right? But there's probably a lot more DPCs out there today than maybe is realized by most. But the DPC that we started with was a startup, a doctor who had left the hospital, and they tried the community approach first, where they were serving the community and accepting insurance, and they couldn't get paid, and they were essentially losing their shirt. So they found us, and after they found us, of course, we created a success story, and then they grew to, in within 5 years, something like 37 employers. But we were their very first. So there was kind of slim pickings, I think, at that time. Like you say, you can't do a Google search and find them. This was a friend of a friend who introduced us, and that's how we got connected.
You talked in our last show about one of the big barriers is adoption and engagement, because the dirty little secret is that we don't have 35 million members. We have maybe a third of that. They're actually adopting their add-on bolt-on plan to their PPO called DPC. The dirty little secret in DPC is there's a lot of tribalism. You're not pure DPC because you're a big corporation funded by venture capital or private equity. So y'all are, profit mongers, which isn't true because the net promoter scores are in the high 80s and low and high 90s for almost every one of the companies I interviewed, which means, world-class net loyalty. The second thing that you'll hear from the companies themselves is, well, they're not really our competitor because, they'll take anybody in the door and we only take 2,000 employees on up at a location. And so there's this, there's no association or organization to represent our industry, our DPC industry. So everybody is tribal a little bit, like maybe, the early days in Italy or the early days even in, tribal America. It feels a lot like that right now. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's fast growing, and I definitely agree with your adoption note in that. I think that's actually one of my fears or concerns is that as many companies imitate this model, that they would do maybe parts and pieces of it, but really leave a lot on the table. And first and foremost, the DPC, I realized early on, I didn't know this when I started with them, but I realized that they are the heartbeat of the strategy that I've developed and subscribed to, that without DPC, I have to say no, I can't even do any of the following things. But this adoption factor, you have these DPCs out there, and then they kind of offer it, and they maybe mention it in the enrollment meeting or something, but you've got 20% participation. I'm not sure that sustains. I'm not sure that even when you, especially if you're on a PMPM payment model where they're paying for every employee and their family member. I'm not sure that sustains. In fact, that's the number one thing. If you said, Matt, what's the number one predictor of your model? Of course, I'm building a lot around this hub of DPC, but the number one predictor is the amount of flow, the amount of participation through that DPC. That would be my one measure.
I have interviewed a couple on my show that clearly are virtual only. I'm not going to say this about all of the virtual only, but a couple that are virtual only, and the less engaged members there are, the more money they make, right? So that's less people on the phone, less white coats on the phone. That model is, as you say, unsustainable, but it's growing because people want to throw something on the wall. they don't have a way of measuring. Again, without an association or a central hub for us all to sit down and talk, there's no quality metrics. So let's throw another question in there about DPCs, and it's the center point of this whole discussion is, I don't really see, I see a lot of case studies, but the objective metrics for outcomes is all over the board. Lesser hospital visits, fewer ER visits, shorter stays, but usually it's just a lower cost thing. I mean, when I asked you the very question a couple of days ago, the answer was, well, we did okay on outcomes and, you know, our retention and our attraction definitely improved by, you know, a couple of decile points. But again, if we had an objective way of measuring success and we could say, look, put it on your front page of your website, here's the ROI you get when you hire our company. Here's the outcomes you get when you hire our company. Here's the quality metrics that we measure internally for KPI. It's just all over the board. And again, that I think is a young industry.
I agree. It's undeveloped. And you know, there's a saying, if you've seen one DPC, you've seen one DPC. So there is some variation, but I think they're more alike than they are different, you know, and there are two big things I would say in terms of, and we could get into measurements and things, but two big reasons why this model of having the DPC as the heartbeat of the strategy is so effective. And number one is we're bringing back the quality of primary care to where it was 40-ish years ago. We're really, you know, so we could say, well, we're highly innovative. Well, we're actually coming back to where we were many decades ago, but we're talking about just time for a visit. You know, we've heard the phrase hurry up and wait, but with today's primary care being reduced to a funnel that the refers, we actually wait and then we hurry up. We wait months to get in and then we get a rushed, what equates to about a 7-minute interaction with a physician who has two people already waiting for him or her when they enter the room. And so we can talk about 30 to 60 minute visits, get in the same or next day, treatment plans for diabetes or blood pressure or obesity or what have you. So with the quality of primary care is, I would say, returned to what it used to be many, many years ago. So that would be my number one.
And on that same thought, I don't want to take away from your number two, but on that same thought, when you get rid of coding and the tap, tap, tap of the doctor not facing you because they got to get it right, that was 40 years ago different too.
Yeah, you look at, you know, it's humorous. You look at some of the bills from 30 or 40 years ago from having a baby or anything, and they're incredibly simple. Most of them are handwritten. And so we, you know, this introduction of the coding process has introduced a lot of waste. You know, I come from Toyota, lean manufacturing background, but this lean applies to life. You know, the simple definition of lean is that we analyze a whole process. You analyze a day's or a week's worth of a physician, and then you say what things in this process are adding value to the customer and what things aren't. And you essentially start cutting all the things that aren't. And I think if we were to do that in healthcare of a doctor's week, we would probably be reducing 50% or more of the things that actually aren't needed, but maybe are required by the insurance company in order for them to get paid or something, but they're adding no value to the patient and they're adding a ridiculous amount of cost.
Which is why burnout goes away, because they're no longer having to do 50% of their day. Okay, what was the second point you were going to make?
So the second would tie right into what you mentioned is what John Tarina said. So he called it, you know, navigation and direct contracts, right? So, and this is probably, it's a little bit harder to equate the first one I mentioned of higher quality primary care to turn that into numbers. I mean, ultimately, we're looking at simply year to year claims cost or money spent on healthcare, right? That's your, and you could even break that down per employee. So if you have a fluctuation there, you can still compare. So that's probably the ultimate measure, knowing that quality is better on actually the independent side and what we're doing. That's a whole nother discussion for another day. But the number two is just smart shopping, we could call it, right? So you could have all the greatest, we don't like the word providers, right? Medical practices around an employer. But if you planted all those medical practices, independent or not, it's really not relevant. We're just talking about fair prices, high quality, and transparent prices, which happen to be the independents today. They still wouldn't be able to use them because guess what? This whole industry has set up a path where they would be out of network. So they would have to go outside the plan to use them. So we have to go in and we have to transform not just being able to find value, say, through navigation, but we have to transform the health plan to enable that. We have to make it not only accessible, but also even more desirable. In our plan, we make it no cost to the member. And so it becomes a no-brainer.
So that leads us to surgery centers. Surgery Center of Oklahoma has done the early work. And now there's companies like Wellbridge in Indiana and Lone Star in Texas. In fact, there's over 60 firms that are now doing independent surgery at a bundled transparent price right on page one of their site. So what is that equivalent in Wisconsin for employers?
We're seeing an explosion of these independent medical practices, a new surgery center in Fusion Oncology in Green Bay, new orthopedic surgery center in Madison. And maybe it's not well known yet, but we actually have an SCO model in Milwaukee, mentored by SCO. And there's one also in Idaho starting. And so SCO has been unselfish to not only pioneer this model, but also to help others. You know, I was talking, I'm going to be meeting with, again, he's a former representative from the House for Wisconsin. And he is telling me, and he said I could share this, he has a surgery scheduled this coming Monday for a shoulder cuff. And he sent me the quote that he got from the hospital, and it was $140,800. So $141,000. And I said, interestingly, I could get you this same surgery because it's on their website, just like SCO. This is called Solstice Health in Milwaukee. For, believe this, now we'd have to look at the details and make sure, but their shoulder cuff line lists at $10,800. So now I don't want to hold to that number, but it'd be close to that. It's a bundled guaranteed amount, even with a warranty attached to it. So, I mean, it almost sounds like we're making up numbers here. But we're also talking then about a handpicked surgeon. We're not talking about some random, you might get the best, you might get the worst in the hospital, right? What do you call the person who finished last in medical school?
So if you look behind the mirror, Matt, what you'll see is the surgeon making less at the 108 than they would at the 10,000. So I've talked to surgeons that work in both avenues. You would be surprised to know maybe that they make less than $1,000 on that surgery. Most of that's hospital fees, medical device costs, anesthesia, out of network. There's just a whole gob of menu items that aren't on a handwritten bill from 40 years ago that don't exist at these transparent. So they actually pay the surgeon sometimes as much as two times as more or three times or four times more than they would make if they worked for the big system. Isn't that crazy?
That is crazy. I've heard that both from Keith Smith and from Tim Murray and others. Tim Murray, the owner of Solstice. Yeah, it's almost hard to believe, but it's
yeah,
true.
Yeah, I have a dear friend who does nothing but carpal tunnel. He doesn't believe it's true so much that he wouldn't even make a phone call to Oklahoma to see what they do. So yeah, what they've got, it's almost like they've trained us like dogs, right? They're like, bad dog, don't do this. Don't go outside the moniker. Don't go outside the logo. Go outside the logo, you're going to get hit on the head and nose with a newspaper.
Well, you know, the facility fee and renting that room for $25,000 or so for a couple hours. I mean, that's, you know, how expensive those rooms are. And of course, I'm being a little sarcastic here.
Yeah. Well, let's talk. Well, it's an expensive logo is what it is. Let's talk a little bit about some of the other. You had 36 items. Let's talk about some other really low hanging fruit. Like, talk about medications.
Yeah, I think that's one big area under the medical strategy that we would carve out. And then we would call that something, you know, like almost a mini subheading of pharmacy strategy. And so pharmacy, by the way, and I think many of the listeners probably realize this, but Pharmageddon, you've heard the phrase maybe, but this is becoming. So pharmacy, the 20-year CFO at Merrill Steel once told me, he said, Matt, when I started, pharmacy was about 4% of our cost. Today, it's about 20% of our cost. And then we started managing that. There's a quick 30 to 50% employers or group health plans can take off their spend just by doing things with integrity with pharmacy. And as John mentioned, that's a finding the first and foremost, the right PBM to help manage those things.
Well, this is where you and I push back on ping pong. I believe We've had two guests on our show. One's called DIRX Directs. Another one's called Scriptco. And their model is you pay $120, $250, $200 a month for access to basically every generic for 1 to 4 pennies a pill. So depending on how many of the employees at an older company like Merrill Steele are on medications, or a younger company like a tech firm, you know, maybe that makes economic sense to pay $120, $200 per member to access this ridiculously low generic cost. But that's I think going to be the future. Again, everything's rolling so fast now, and so many interesting opportunities. But I believe wholesale direct pharmacy is really a much better. Well, you don't need a PBM if your medications are $3.60 every 90 days, right?
Right. And I wouldn't disagree with you there. Yeah. Pharmacy is an area, if I have a weak link, it's maybe an area that I don't have a lot of interest. So, but definitely agree. It comes down to why shopping for value. And I would say maybe first, you know, anything you can do to shop wisely for value. So let's not even assume that a PBM is needed or adding value.
Okay. Let's talk about Care Navigator. I've seen two different kinds built into the TPA. And then I had it on the show, a company called Acerta Health. And what they've done is they've contracted ahead of schedule with all of the big systems out there to get Medicare plus 120, Medicare 140. They're not going to 250, which is their posted rate that they have to do now because of Consolidated Appropriations Act. So what they're doing is they're cutting deals all over the country for employers. What do you think of that as a navigator?
I would say this in general, right? I mean, and that's why I say the number one measure through the DPC is, it would be my number one measure, maybe not everybody's measure, but as we talk about plan design, as we talk about navigation, the hardest part is to get the patient to understand that this isn't just too good to be true, it's actually true, right? So that's the biggest challenge of navigators, is to gain trust. Now, people listen to the white coat. There's psychology research on this, plenty of it, that the white coat represents authority. So that's one of the big advantages. If they go to the DPC first, it's a pretty easy navigation. They'll trust that caregiver and listen. And so then we also, like in our plan, and I think some are going there, we have actually real-time claims data on the medical and pharmacy side. So that's pretty unique. That allows us to reach out on a pre-auth trigger, or to reach the patient before the service has been performed. And so we'll put the nurse right in front of them in the enrollment meetings, and then say, this is the cell phone. This is your nurse. You're not going to get some random nurse. You can get to know, in this case, you can get to know her. And so trying to build that trust factor. So that's really not the details of navigation itself, which we could get into. But I just want to mention that, you know, that trust factor is how you get them to do it. Because when you call and say, you can spend $5,000 for the MRI, or we have a free option, that sounds almost too good to be true when they just got advice from a doctor in a white coat at a hospital that says our MRI has a better lens. I've actually heard that. So there's all sorts of things happening there that, you know, even on the people side, before you get into the actual navigation.
It sounds like a carnival barker. We got the better lens than the guy next door, and they got the better lens than we have, but we just bought a new one. So that's ridiculous. Okay. So let me push back on what you just said again, because this is, I love this conversation, by the way, but there was a company we had on the show. It was about six shows ago, called Health E, with double E's at the end. They have 500,000 members in their first year. They're an artificial intelligence solution to take these big, thick plan documents and convert them into choices for the employee when they get on their plan. So it's an engagement app and a navigation app, basically. There is no trust me involved. There is no listen to this navigator involved. They are the navigator. Here's your cost if you go to Wellbridge in Indiana. Here's your cost if you go to option B. Here's your cost if you go through your PPO plan. And here are the options of people you can see, the actual surgeons you can see. So again, with artificial intelligence, they've just built in, just touch here, touch here, touch here, click, 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 and you're already through to making your choice. You don't have to talk to anybody, no phone calls to make, no friction. It's a beautiful thing. And I do believe they say they can go live with a new employer in 5 days.
Sounds very interesting. I would go back to my first comment of, you've just got to get them to do it, right? So, and so that's the only way I found to do it. Now, if you have a tool, now we have some tech built in as well, but if you have the path maybe for them, I don't think patients can navigate themselves wisely, but with someone holding their hand, a doctor, a nurse, or someone, I think, so I would maybe question that on the participation level. But wouldn't disagree that if you can do it with AI, that's great, right? I mean, I'm all for that. So, but I think the key is that if we find in this maybe interaction model that if they don't trust you, they're not going to listen to you, and then they'll get the $5,000 bill, and maybe they will next time. But that model sounds interesting. If you can direct them on a path where they can navigate effectively, where they have at least the knowledge, right? What is an MRI? Why do I need one? And so forth. That sounds like something that could be workable. And right, the goal is to get them to do it. And if they do it, now you're shopping wisely. So goal achieved.
They almost sound like a digital captive. Well, let's talk about other low-hanging fruit. What other of the 36 points of light are you excited about talking as a low-hanging plan design? Perfect, ideal plan design.
Yeah, I think often the question I get, in this, the medical is the most complicated, but it's the first two are incredibly important, and I'll kind of just skim the surface of those. But number one, what I would call trustworthy partner. So I think so often when a problem that's been around for 20 years is much harder to recognize than one that just happened because we've gotten used to it. And so we take a step back and we say, do I really trust, right? We ask these questions about our mechanic or our plumber or whomever. But do I really trust the partners I'm working with? I remember talking to this, I won't say the names, this giant PBM that we had at Mural Steel. And we only had, it was hard to get them on the phone, first of all, but we had two or three discussions, and they're trying to take me to games and things. That was their focus. But I, every time I left almost mad, I'm like, they would not answer my questions. I asked it three different times. They would not answer my questions. And then I find out there's all these sneaky things built into the contracts and so forth. So we switched, of course. I realized that I didn't have trustworthy partners, that they were out for a win-lose, and they wanted this opaque, right, non-transparent stuff. So I think first and foremost, if you're going to build a team, if you're building a basketball team or a football team or a work team, you've got to trust the people you're working with. If they've got different motives, you're in trouble. So, and then the other big part would be a financial. I remember just doing a financial analysis. Take the business skills that you already have and apply them to healthcare. I remember the CFO who had actually done a really good job, but I sat down with him at Merrill Steel, and he printed out this sheet one day. This was a whole list of TPA charges, of summary charges, $5 PM, PEPM here, 10, 15, et cetera. This was a whole page, probably 20 things. We sat down and we went just through it line by line. He didn't know, and this was his humility. He said, I don't know what half of these things are, Matt. We found duplications. We saved $100,000 in about an hour discussion just by using the skills that we apply to the rest of the business. But healthcare had been off the radar. So I think a complete financial analysis from the advisor, from the broker advisors. Brokers sell products. They don't really care about the results, right? The traditional status quo broker is there to sell as many insurance products with as many commissions as possible. That's not very helpful. What you need is an advisor who shares in your outcomes, whose compensation is aligned with your outcomes. And so they don't make more when you get worse. I mean, that sounds almost dumb to say, but those trustworthy partners out even bleeds into the financial strategy as well and aligned compensation. So that would be, that would be my summary, Ron, of, a skimmed summary of the trustworthy partners and the financial. And of course, the money is really, once you have those, the table set, then the savings are to be found in the medical strategy.
You just brought up, I think, another Achilles heel in our ecosystem is that today, the brokers that are gathering together are working on smaller plans. They're not working on 1,000, 2,000, 5,000. They're celebrating still, a company, a hotel or a hospital that has 150 employees. So it doesn't seem to me like the advisor market is growing up, getting into the jumbo employer market very quickly. There are a few, but just a very few. Do you agree with that?
I think very few is a great way to describe it. I think when they see market opportunity, especially the low market share ones, are getting excited. But it appears to me, and I have many friends in this industry, but it appears to me, you scratch our head and say, why are they digging in their heels? And why are they still following this path that is unsustainable? It's like you're driving for a cliff and you're not turning the steering wheel or hitting the brakes. And I think it's because their enterprises are built on these commissioned, these highly commissioned, big checks, models. And I'm not sure. And I think until the market forces them to steer away, they've got it captured right now. So, and that's one of the things we're doing is working with lower market share advisors. And they're excited because they're like, this is easy pickings here, right? Employers are looking for solutions, and their status quo big time broker is not offering them. They're just offering new, they're rearranging the chairs on the Titanic, but they're not actually doing things that would lower cost.
Yeah, the advisors that are with the big letter agencies are basically masters at sowing fear, uncertainty, and doubt. The FUD thing. Let's talk a little bit about your company and what you're doing there with sort of a wrapper around a perfect plan. What does somebody get when they come into your self-funded help?
Yeah, so this is a plan that was employer designed and employer proven. So myself at Merrill Steel, and then actually quite a few other employers in the state now are utilizing this model. But this is a product. This is an assembled, self-funded, high-performing plan that we partner with advisors. There's some rare cases where the employers are their own advisor, and that's an option. But we partner with the small few. Really, advisors who are now passionate about fixing healthcare. And so this proven model does what it does best. It works. It can save 20 to 30% off the health plan cost, and it can change the trajectory of the cost for both the employer and the employee. So it's an amazing win. It's very inspiring to see. And so the more advisors that adopt this, the more we can go in Wisconsin and beyond.
So if a company's saving $5 million on a $20 million spend, that all drops to the bottom line. So that is basically, you would have to maybe get, I don't know what the margins are in steel, but let's just say 10% to get $5 million to your bottom line, you'd have to sell $50 million worth of steel. Do y'all ever sell the idea that way, that we're your best salesman you never had to hire?
I think companies are waking up to this. Healthcare is off the radar, and it's a head scratcher as far as why. I think it's not viewed as a normal business expense. I remember going to the owners, who was the president at the time at Merrill Steel, and talking about simplicity of a $500 MRI or a 5,000. And I said, "Did you realize that you're writing a check for this? This is not in so-called insurance and so forth. You're writing a check." And he just smiled ear to ear. He said, "I didn't know that. Thank you. Let's go." Right. And so, yeah, I don't know if companies realize. I mean, how many, if you're in manufacturing, which is a Wisconsin's the 10th largest, how many products do you have to make? And how, in no other area of the business do you just throw away money for bad shopping, right? So as we start to apply these already present skill sets to healthcare, pretty amazing things happen. Put your purchasing manager in charge of your healthcare, see what happens.
Well, PBGH is the largest purchasing alliance in the country. Walmart is in there, Costco's in there. And Walmart discovered centers of excellence in 2019, saved $1 billion on a $9 billion spend. Incredible. And then the next thing they did is they offered college for every employee, part-time, full-time, day one, because they've got to get caught up with Costco's 6 or 7% turnover when Walmart at the time had 40%. So they're, you can't churn through all of America. Eventually, everybody's worked at Walmart. So they have, by necessity, to compete with Amazon and Costco, they have to get their turnover numbers down and keep people longer and not train, put as much money into training new people all the time. So these strategies are actually becoming a matter of survival, because if your competitor has these strategies and you don't, guess what? You're not competitive.
Well, and having a 25-year and background in HR, right? I mean, the things have changed in the last 5 to 10 years dramatically. It's an absolute battle for talent, and what better way to improve your healthcare cost? I ran into a company the other day, and maybe this is common across America. Wisconsin's one of the worst states, but they had a $1,000 premium for the single level. And it's like, my goodness, how do you recruit to that? Right. I mean, so I had employees at Merrill Steel come up to me and talk and just rave about the benefits. And they said, even if I thought about leaving, I couldn't. And so it's a big deal.
Because we ran out of time, like we always do when we talk, I would like to know what you would tell, if you're sitting next to an HR leader on an airplane who's curious about these ideas, what would you tell them in terms of getting these models on board their own company?
It's a complicated answer, as you know. And I'd hand him my book and maybe give him a copy of my book or something. I think would tell the whole story. But yeah, start with the skill sets that you already know. Put healthcare on the radar as a business expense, and then maybe apply the skills that you already know. You find trustworthy partners, you're analyzing where the dollars are going, you're making sure all these under the table dollars are visible. And then develop a strategy to spend less for medical, to shop wisely for medical. Mm-hmm. And amazing things can happen.
All right. Well, Matt, since we already flew a banner over America last time we spoke, this time we're just going to ask, how can people get in touch with you if they want to connect?
Yeah, I think I've got a LinkedIn account. You can connect with me there, or matt@selffundhealth.com.
Okay, Matt. Thank you again. And I always enjoy our conversations.
Thanks, Ron. Likewise.
I have been a happy customer of Redirect Health since before I started the show, guys, and I know firsthand the integrity and laser focus on us of the members of its two founders, Dave Berg and Dr. Janice Johnson. What do I get from me and my team? Well, I have 24/7 access to my healthcare team for any reason, and they have all my medical records right at their fingertips at all times. So no more filling out those stupid forms in clinics. And if I need a refill, if I got a rash, I've hurt my back, I need an annual physical, Redirect Health takes it from there. I just tell them on my app what I need. We get free primary care visits and chiropractic and labs and patient assistance with meds, which means you can get free meds for a lot of your employees, probably most of them actually, and hospitalization with a $2,000 deductible. All of that is in my plan for about half what I used to pay in a traditional high deductible plan. But I have zero deductibles, zero copays except for that $2,000. So I go to get my care with my own doctor, or they'll find one for me. You keep your doctor with this plan, and I pay nothing there at the clinic after. It's super clean. What a friction-free plan should look like, right? And it's much less chance of any surprise bills, and Redirect totally handles all the hassles when my doctor's billing department in the hospital messes up, and they mess up 80% of the time. Well, I'm treated like a person, not a number at Redirect. So I'll say it on this show a million times and on my LinkedIn posts dozens of times, I use Redirect Health. If you want to get the business owner's guide to slashing healthcare premiums, go to get.redirecthealth.com/Ron. get.redirecthealth.com/Ron.
Thanks for listening. You can advance our movement by subscribing, and kindly take a minute and leave a review. Each is a win for this show. Until next episode.